Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'm delighted to welcome back to the program Herbert Woodward Martin. He joins us in studio here at Soundspace in Yellow Springs. Hello, Herb.
Hello. Thank you for inviting me.
It's been a long time.
It has been, yes.
And I see you've written a new collection of poems, and it's called On the Flyleaf.
That's right. It stems from my reading other collections of poems and not having my notebook with me. And so I turned to the very last pages of the book that I'm reading, and they are empty. They're blank. And so I make notes for new poems on those sheets of paper. And those sheets are by the publisher called Flyleafs. And so that's where I get the title from.
And are these then sort of a call and response, a reaction to the poetry that you've been reading?
I suspect it's something like that. It's inspiration, but it's also inventing as a process and seeing where that's going to take me. So I am in some ways playing wingman to other people's poems and seeing how that inspires and how that influences me. And sometimes an idea just comes out of nowhere that may or may not be related to those people, so I feel like I owe them an apology, first of all.
So did you realize at one point that you'd written on all these fly leaves and that you could put a collection together, or did you just decide you wanted to do this and write some more to add to them?
No, it's that I had been doing it for, I would dare say, 10 to 15, maybe even 20 years, two decades. And suddenly I realized that I had all of these flyleaf poems that I had started out with. I think the very first one was by Leaves to Hypnos by René Char, the French poet. And from there, it just exploded, I think. And I just kept on doing it. And then suddenly, there was a book of poems that my biographer said, you ought to put these together. And so I started to think about that. And one thing led to another, and I finally had a book.
Who's your biographer?
That's Ron Primo. He wrote a biography called Herbert Martin and the African-American Tradition in Poetry. I think that's the right title. And Kent State brought it out some years ago.
We're joined by Herb Martin, his new collection of poetry, On the Flyleaf. And it was very helpful to me as I read these poems. I would turn back to the back where you have sources by title and author, and I would look to see which flyleaf you were writing on.
Yes.
We go down this list, and a lot of these names will be familiar to our listeners, and a lot of them won't be.
Yeah.
In fact, I noticed some of them you weren't actually responding to poetry.
No. I was probably responding to a piece of prose or even a playwright. So all of those things sort of generate and get the juices flowing. And so I'm hoping that it makes sense when I'm writing these pieces, but I can never tell.
Well, I'm sure our listeners are waiting eagerly for you to read some poetry. Have you picked some out to share?
Well, I will. There's one that I want to read, and I think it is, it's on the flyleaf of The Last Uncle. I open The Last Uncle on a page using an envelope as a bookmark. I read the 43rd anniversary, a poem by Linda Paston. You may never have read her, but it becomes abundantly clear by the expert placement of her words that she is patently aware of you and that you are in her imagination. She is an intuitive magician who understands the clever blocking of a play better than directors and knows by instinct the glory of how one art intersects with all the other arts.
I love that one. And you're getting inside Linda's head in a way, aren't you?
Well, I'm trying in many ways. And that was an interesting book of poems. I met her years and years ago at Breadloaf when she was a fellow. And I think I may have been a scholar at that. And so we have sort of remained in contact, and I have purchased pretty much every book that she's written. And I find that the poems are so simple on the page, but I know that the craft that goes into those, making of those poems, is really horrendous. And so I admire her work for that reason.
Herb, you've been in the Dayton area for a number of years, but you didn't come from Dayton originally. Give our listeners a little pocket biography, if you will.
Well, this is how I remember it. We came to Ohio in the 40s. My father had come first, my mother second, and I came third. And we came to Toledo, Ohio. That's where we went. And I went to high school there, and then I went to the University of Toledo there. And then I graduated some years later after struggling to pay for all the fees and everything, and went off to Buffalo. And I stayed there for 3 years, finished my work there, and started to teach in Michigan, in Grand Rapids, Michigan, of all places. And I stayed there for 3 years and was on a reading tour. And I came to Cincinnati, to Illinois for some reason, and then to Dayton. And when I, in all three places, offered me a job. And so when I got home, I was exhausted, and my best friend said, "I've never seen you this tired." And I said, "Well, I've got to decide where I'm going." And so I just took my finger and I just went, pointed, and it stopped on Dayton. So I picked Dayton, though I had not intentionally intended to come to Dayton. So that's and I've was going to stay for just 3 years because I'd stayed in Grand Rapids for 3 years. But my mother said, "Why are you jumping from job to job?" And I said, "Well, I'm giving 3 years to the Catholics, 3 years to the Protestants, 3 years to the atheists, 3 years to the Jews, and then I can do whatever I want." And she said to me, "Are they nice to you at that place, at that college?" And I said, "Yes." "Are they giving you raises?" And I said, "Yes." Then she said, "Why are you moving?" And it took me a long time to remember that my mother worked during the Depression. So if you had a job, you kept it. It was a job for life. And I think that she was still thinking that. She just didn't want me to be scatter-minded and to run from job to job to job. So
you stayed.
Yeah.
So you say you were on a reading tour. What were you doing? What were you reading?
I was reading all of the poems that I hadn't put into a book. But by 1969, I had my first book, and nobody could ever get it right. It was New York, the 9 million, and other poems. So they'd mix up the millions and the number nine. So I thought I must get a different title the next time around. I was reading those poems, and I had at that point invented the contrapuntal poem, which works down the page and up the page. So I could incrementally do lines that would work either way and would work in a circular fashion as well. So that was supposed to be the invention that was going to get me into all the anthologies. Well, I must say it hadn't done that. So we can move on to something else.
Herb Martin joins us. When did you first come to the realization that you are a poet?
I don't know if you ever realized that. I remember Frost saying it was a title that you couldn't sort of put around your own shoulders. Somebody else had to do it for you, and that would be the recognition that you had the ability and the talent to become this thing. But I don't know. I liked writing. I liked trying to tell stories and inventing an action around a single incident. And all of those things seem to have come together for me. And there were lots of people who, I would dare say, encouraged me. And probably there were lots of editors with their rejection slips who tried to persuade me not to do this thing. But I've kept at it, and practice makes you a little better, I think. So,
Herbert Woodward Martin joins us. His new collection of poetry is On the Flyleaf, and he was kind enough to come all the way out here to Yellow Springs to the studios at Soundspace to record this interview. Would you read us another poem, please?
Sure. As I look through this, there are lots of things which sort of attract me, and I'm not really sure why, but when I left Alabama in the 40s, I was on the train by myself, and the conductor came through the train, and he said, "We have just crossed the Mason and Dixie line." And I thought at 12 and a half, and that's that. And strangely enough, that meant that I closed the door completely on Birmingham and Alabama and everything else. And I never looked back at any of that until maybe 20 years, 30. And then I opened the door and peeked in, and there were, I would dare say, 100 experiences about which I could make poems. And some of them are decent. And so a lot of the poems from this new book is about those experiences. This is On the Flyleaf of Poems, 1965 to 1975, a nun Spenserian sonnet. When they were not drinking, the family men, my father, David, along with my uncles, Addison, Peter, and Bud, who ventured into righteous sin in Birmingham from the country, the city on a dare, they would disappear. Where they went, I do not know. They returned with affections in the evening, with a few measly dollars lent or borrowed, which they promptly contributed to our necessary larder, the need for flour, meal, sugar, black-eyed peas, salt pork, and greens, delectable greens. They accompanied their frightening task repeatedly and repetitiously, day in and day out, leaving me to question who would teach me the technical mysteries of exactly what they did when they vanished during those long days when I was 7 years old and had no marketable skills to speak of.
Herb Martin reading from his new collection, On the Flyleaf. There's something very musical about so many of these poems, and you have done a lot of collaborative work involving music, haven't you?
Yes, I've worked with a number of distinguished American composers. And one of the things you try to figure out is where the arch of the phrase is going. And that, I think, is one of the ways that musicians set your words, so that they're giving a clue to the singer as to how he or she might phrase or paraphrase the phrase and sing the phrase. And I thought it was a pretty good idea, so I've incorporated it as much as I can into my own work, so that if I'm not around to tell somebody how to read it, they can read to the end of the line or read to the first piece of punctuation, and they'll pretty much come up with how I think that they might be able to make sense out of the poem.
As we look at the back and we see the flyleaf information where you originally wrote these poems and these various books, it gives us a sense of your library and how much you love to read.
Yes. Well, I think one of the other things that I want to know is who's doing what and how well are they doing it. And sometimes you need to understand what the competition is out there and to gauge where your work might or might not fit in. And so I'm just reading because sometimes you can get another perspective from another writer that you hadn't thought about. And that leads you into an area or into a landscape that you hadn't even considered. So that's one of the reasons why I read.
Conrad Balliet has kept poetry alive on WYSO for a
yes.
number of years, and I'm sure he's delighted to hear some poetry on this program.
Well, I bet he is. Yeah, he has been, I think, a godsend to Montgomery County in the Miami Valley for many, many years, and I hope there are many, many more because he has featured everyone that he could get to come to the studios to read their poems.
Do you have another one picked out that you'd be willing to share with our audience?
Let me I'm trying to avoid some of the why don't I read you the very first one? I was teaching somewhere in Portsmouth, Ohio, in a visiting professorship. And there was one man in the class who was really very, very gifted. And somewhere midway through the semester, he just disappeared. And somebody said he had to go to work to help take care of the family. And that bothered me for a long, long time, and I tried to make a poem out of that. And I am reading a book of poems by a former student of mine, and it's called On the Flyleaf of the Silent Singer. Work arrives. He carries a gun loaded with point-blank metaphors, demands the best young male in the class, takes him away at gunpoint. I am unable to restrain them with music. There were seeds in that male whose roots were ready to grow into tutored gardens. Now he has been missing for weeks. In bars and mines, he digs with his hands nightly and daily for the personification of money, the seduction of feminine allure. He has not yet learned how to keep the wolves from eating his heart.
Wow. That's Herb Martin reading from his new collection, On the Flyleaf. And this is published by a publisher here in Ohio, Bottom
yes.
Dog Press. And they publish a lot of poetry, don't they?
Yes, they do. And they also publish fiction as well. They've done a number of novels from people in the area. So I'm really sort of in with a nice group of people. And They produce them, and I think, an excellent product, even if I have to talk about my own book that way. Sure.
And a lot of these poems have appeared elsewhere, correct?
Sure.
In various anthologies.
Yes, yes.
Newspapers.
Newspapers mm-hmm. and journals as well. So I'm really very pleased that these poems have a life outside of this book, so people can pick and choose.
What is the process for you as a poet when you have a poem that you want to share, that you want to put out in the world? How do you do that? How do you send it? What do you do?
Well, what I do is now I'm working more and more after I do the drafts on the computer, and I go through, and I will write a poem. And then what I call a period where it marinates and gets seasoned, and I can go back and tinker with punctuation and another word and a different kind of placement. And once all of that is done, I finally decide that I have to let the poem go. And then I try to pick a journal that I think might like it. I try to pick a journal that might have published something like it, although that's dangerous because if they've already done one poem, they're not going to take another one. They want something different and what they feel is new. So sometimes I send blindly and it comes back blindly, but sometimes I'm surprised that out of the three or four that I submit, they take something that I could not even have fathomed that they would take. So you don't know. And it's still, I think, still a difficult process of hit and miss. But I'm sure that there are other people who have agents who know exactly where to send the poem and it gets accepted. But I'm still doing that. So I can't tell anybody except that I think you have to send out and you have to do it weekly, sometimes lots monthly, and certainly a good number over a full year. And I think I've come to the fact, somebody told me that if you have 100 poems out, you can expect that 10 of them will be taken. And so 10% of whatever you send out is going to make it through the reading process.
So it pays to be prolific and to just keep sending them.
Yeah, I think to keep sending it out. You can't get depressed and say, oh, boy, they didn't take my poem. I'm a great poet. And then you fall on the floor and thrash around for 5 or 6 days. Well, you've lost 5 or 6 days. So when I get a rejection, I send 2 more things out. And that way, and then I can feel bad if I want to feel bad, but I start to think something is going to get taken from those 2 new submissions that I sent out. And so that's the way I think it works, is you just have to keep the stuff out there because somebody who rejects one thing, someone else will take it. And if you don't send it, then no one will take it. So.
And you remain undeterred and optimistic, even with what someone else would characterize as a 90% failure rate.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, you gotta do it. If you want somebody to read your work, first of all, you got to make it as good as you can make it. And then once you think that the poem can stand up on its own 2 legs without you being there to encourage you, then I send it out and it can make its own way because it has to make its own way without me anyway. Mm. And so that's what I do. I just send it out. And if it comes back, I look to see if I've misspelled something, if I've put the wrong phrase on the wrong line, and I adjust and tinker, and then I send it out again.
Hmm. And I'm guessing that over the years, the U.S. mail was the preferred way to do that. But in this modern time, can you submit via email now?
Yeah, and of course it's complicated because certain people have submission managers, and some of them have submission managers where you have to pay $3 to have the poems read. And then there are those who want you not to use an email, but to send it as a document. And then there's others who want you to paste the poem into your email. So you have to go through all these little hoops in order to get it in the right place.
Right.
And so somebody rejected something because now they have an online submission manager. And so now I have to send the poems to them again. And I'm just a little bit skeptical of that because you have to put in a credit card number.
Oh.
And when people hack into those systems, I just think, oh, that's too dangerous. So I don't do it. And I try other things.
Understandable. My guest today has been Herbert Woodward Martin. His new collection of poetry is on the flyleaf. And I think we've probably set a record, Herb, because we've talked for almost 30 minutes, and three words have not been said during this interview. Paul Lawrence Dunbar, because
Oh, wow.
I think anyone that talks to you, when you think Herbert Woodward Martin, many of us think Paul Lawrence Dunbar, because the two of you are so connected, I think, in the minds of many of us.
Yeah, sometimes I'm in the grocery store and there's one or two people who go by and they say, "How do you do, Mr. Dunbar?" And so then I think, oh, I can't ever have a life of my own. But you're right. That connection is there and probably will never go away.
Well, here's what I'm thinking. If you're amenable, we'd love to have you come back and talk about Dunbar on our program next week, if you're comfortable with that.
I would be happy to do that, and that would be a godsend for me. So I look forward to coming back.
And what kinds of things can we expect next week? Or can you read us some Dunbar poetry? You've done that on the program before.
Yes, I can read you some Dunbar poems and maybe even read you one or two that are not in dialect, but in standard English.
Sounds great. You've been listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. My guest has been Herbert Woodward Martin. His new collection of poetry is on the flyleaf. Tune in next week. We're going to have Herb back on again, and we're going to be talking about Paul Lawrence Dunbar in the Book Nook. I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks for listening. Herb Martin will be doing a couple of poetry readings coming up. You can go and hear him read on March 23rd, that's Sunday. He'll be at the Peripatetic Poets Meeting at Mozart's Bakery in Columbus. That's 4784 North High Street from 5:30 until 7:30. Also on Thursday, March 27th, Herb will be at the Troy Hainer Cultural Center, 301 West Main Street in Troy, Ohio. And that will be at 7:30. And Herb will be reading a program of his own poetry for half of the evening, and Paul Lawrence Dunbar for the other half. You heard it in the Book Nook. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.